Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. 3 minutes after 9 a.m. Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. Joined today by my co-chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, myself, Stedman. Senator McGuire will probably be joining us later. Today, we have six bills on the agenda this morning. I'm going to start with Senate Bill 19, Passenger Vehicle Rental Tax. And then we're going to have, and that's been before the committee before, we're going to then go on to four new pieces of legislation for the committee to review. Senate Bill 92, Dental Hygienist and Assistants. Senate Bill 66, ADA, New Market Tax Credit Program. It's the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Senate Bill 90, the Board of Public Accountancy Secretary. And then we'll have Senate Bill 94, Second Burst of the Alaska Flag Zone. Then we'll finish up, hopefully this morning, with Senate Bill 97, Community Revenue Sharing and Educational Funding. And we have a CS that we're working on there, and hopefully it'll be ready by the time we get to that on the agenda. If not, we'll most likely take a recess to the call of the chair and continue when we have that particular piece of legislation. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and start today's work with Senate Bill 19 by Senator French regarding the passenger vehicle rental tax. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time on March 8th. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute and look to the role of the committee. With that, we have Senator French, his representative from his office, being come forward. And Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 19 Finance /M as a working document.
And I'll object for explanation. And I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and invite Mr. Peterson up here. He's already there. If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, Mr. Peterson, and walk us through this CS, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. The previous version of the bill simply amended the definition section of the vehicle rental tax statutes by adding motorcycles to the list of vehicles that are not considered a passenger vehicle, thereby eliminating the 10% tax on those rentals. We agree that a 10% tax is too high, considering that motorcycles have a minimal impact on our roads, and the motorcycle rental business is an emerging industry that we want to support. We acknowledge the fact that motorcycles were an oversight when passenger vehicle rental tax was first established, but we counter the notion that motorcycles should be totally exempt. Therefore, this committee substitute strikes a compromise and taxes motorcycle rentals at 3%, which is the same rate as recreational vehicles. Passenger vehicles will continue to be taxed at 10%. Motorcycles and recreational vehicles will be 3%.
Okay, and at the last hearing, the committee had several questions that have been answered in a letter from the Department of Revenue, and it's dated to March 9th, which is included in your packet this morning. Do any committee members have any other questions, objections to the adoption? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection for the adoption of the amendment. We have any further objections for the adoption of the CS? Not the amendment, but the CS. Seeing none, the CS version M is adopted. There's one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue showing a $12,000 reduction in vehicle rental tax. The committee will request a forthcoming fiscal note to reflect changes made in the committee substitute. We have taken public testimony at the last hearing. Any other final questions or concerns on this bill? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee move out CS for Senate Bill 19 Finance /M with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill version M from committee with individual recommendations and the forthcoming fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. Next up, Senate Bill 92 by Senator Egan regarding the dental hygienist and assistants. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today, Senator Egan. Senator Egan, do you want to explain what we have here in front of us, or?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 92, Labor and Commerce, clarifies statutes for dental hygienists, dentists, and the Board of Dental Examiners. And with your permission, I would like to bring my staff, Dana Owen, forward to explain the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dana Owen, the staff to Senator Egan, also staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, where we heard the bill.
You want to tell us what we got in front of us?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to invite David Logan of the Dental Society. He's sitting here next to me to answer questions. The bill was brought to us by a combination of dentists and dental hygienists. It's worth pointing out that the dental hygiene statute, or the dentistry and dental hygiene statutes, had not been comprehensively reviewed in over 20 years. The bill runs to 20 pages. It makes a number of changes to the statutes, most of which are reflections of changes in dental practicry. There's also some changes that are brought about because of changes in regulatory framework. And also, we have some changes to accommodate the more modern communications technology that we have today. The committee who worked on this bill and brought us the initial changes is composed of three dentists and three dental hygienists. One of the dentists and one of the dental hygienists each sits on the Board of Dentistry. The committee originally had a sunset provision in the bill. As you may recognize, Mr. Chairman, we split that sunset provision off from the larger bill simply because it was important that the board be reauthorized this year. And we felt that because of the extensive nature of the changes, that may drag down or slow down the progress of the reauthorization of the board. So we introduced two bills. This committee already has the reauthorization bill, and I understand that the reauthorization is also in the omnibus bill that is currently in the other body. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I can walk you through the bill section by section. There are, I think, 35 or 36 sections in the bill. If that would be your preference, I can do it that way.
Well, yeah, that'd be nice for you to do that, please.
Mm-hmm. excuse me. Section 1 removes a requirement that a person practicing dental hygiene or who is offering to practice dental hygiene must have a current certificate of registration. You'll see throughout the bill that we remove the requirement for a certificate of registration because it's simply no longer in use. We also have a provision that maintains a registry, that is to say a list of dentists and hygienists in the state, maintained by the board. However, they no longer have to issue a certificate of registration, and you'll see that reflected in a number of sections in the bill. Section 2 establishes qualifications necessary for licensure as a dental hygienist. Section 3 amends the qualifications necessary for a dental hygienist to be licensed by credentials. Mr. Chairman, this section puts those requirements, rather than setting them in statute, it gives the power to the board to adopt them by regulation. It was felt that this would give them more flexibility. In the view of the sponsor and the view of the committee that brought this, that's a better way of doing it than setting it in statute, simply because it is a self-regulated profession. As things change, they're more capable of setting those regulations and quicker and more flexibly than is the legislature through statute. Mm-hmm. Section 4 edits the dental hygiene licensing provision to provide that successful applicants for licensure no longer be registered by the Board of Dental Examiners. And again, this is one of those reflections of the change in maintaining a register as opposed to maintaining a list by the board. Sections 5 and 6 conform the renewal of license and lapse and reinstatement of license provisions to the bill's removal of the registration requirement. Section 7 allows a dental hygienist who has completed a course offered by or under the auspices of a program accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association or other equivalent course or program to receive a restorative function endorsement from the board. And if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I would ask Mr. Logan, or Dr. Logan, to explain what that, the technical part of that is.
Dr. Logan?
Why don't we just have you continue to walk through the bill, and then if we have questions that you can't answer, we'll defer to someone else to answer.
Certainly. Section 8 changes the level of supervision required for a dental hygiene student performing dental hygiene procedures, makes the section applicable to all students enrolled in dental hygiene programs. Sections 9 through 11 change the permitted scope of practice for a dental hygienist and clarifies what practices and procedures may not be delegated to a dental hygienist by a dentist. Section 12 clarifies what practices and procedures a dental hygienist who has entered into a collaborative agreement with a dentist may be authorized by the dentist to perform. Section 13 makes some stylistic changes that the drafter felt were necessary. Section 14 permits the board to sanction a dental hygienist who used or knowingly cooperated in deceit, fraud, or intentional misrepresentation to obtain a certificate or endorsement and amends other grounds for discipline, suspension, or revocation of a dental hygienist's license. Section 15 gives the board the authority to impose a civil fine of up to $25,000 for a violation of AS 0832 or a regulation adopted under that chapter. Section 16 amends the list of dental hygienists to whom the provisions of AS 0832 do not apply. And I would point out at this time that we added language to that section of the bill which is inadequate to the task. We will be bringing forward an amendment at another more appropriate time for the committee's consideration. That amendment has been drafted by our drafter in collaboration with lawyers from the South Central Foundation, who pointed out to us that conditions in rural Alaska require certain things that we inadvertently were not authorizing in the bill, and we can explain that to you at a later time. Section 17 provides new definitions applicable to AS 0832 for licensed dental hygienist and licensed dentist. Section 18 adds a qualification for a public member of the board. Section 19 requires the members of the board to take an oath, requires the board to adopt a seal. Section 20 requires the president of the board to be a dentist or a dental hygienist. Section 21 amends the powers of the board. Section 22 requires the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to employ an investigator for the board. Section 23 requires the board to establish standards for dental radiological equipment that comply with federal law, permits the board to charge a fee for equipment registered under this section, and removes the requirement that inspections of radiologic equipment be performed by a person with certain qualifications. Section 24 requires the board to maintain a registry of persons licensed as dentists or dental hygienists and persons certified as dental assistants and a registry of licenses, certificates, and endorsements revoked by the board. Section 25 edits the dentist licensing provision to provide that successful applicants for a license will no longer be registered by the board. Section 26 amends the qualifications for a license to practice dentistry in the state. Section 27 requires that an applicant for licensure as a dentist must be interviewed in person by the board. Sections 28 and 29 amend what is necessary for a dental hygienist to be licensed by credentials. Section 30 permits all persons enrolled as students in an accredited school of dentistry to perform dental procedures without a license if certain conditions are met. Section 31 conforms the renewal of registration provision to the bill's removal of the registration requirements for dentists. Section 32 provides that a dentist who does not pay the license renewal fee forfeits the dentist's license, permits the board to reinstate a license under certain conditions. Section 33 amends the grounds for discipline, suspension, or revocation of a license to practice dentistry. Section 34 permits a dental assistant who has completed a course offered by or under the auspices of a program accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association or other equivalent course or program to receive a restorative function endorsement from the board. Section 35 adds a new provision allowing persons enrolled in a program or course of study to perform dental assisting procedures as part of that course or study program without a certificate if certain conditions are met. Section 36 adds a new section that provides who may own, operate, or maintain a dental practice, office, or clinic. Section 37 provides new definitions applicable to AS 0836 for certified dental assistant, licensed dental hygienist, and licensed dentist. Section 35 is a series of repealers, and Section 29 is instructions to the reviser.
So we go back to page 18, line 28, on the ownership of the dental office and facility. What's the reasoning behind that? New section.
Mr. Chairman,
line 28, page 18.
Line 28, I'm sorry. We added, if I recall,
For the record, David Logan, I'm a dentist here in Juneau, Alaska, and representing the Alaska Dental Society. I can answer that question if you would like, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Currently, there wasn't a provision that would allow a surviving spouse, if a dentist died, to actually have ownership of that practice during a transition period. So we had originally put in a year. It was requested by Senator Menard that we increase that to 2 years there, which we took as a friendly offer there, since she had gone through some of the same items there. So it's a way to have a transitional period that a spouse can actually have ownership of the practice. They wouldn't have control of the practice. A licensed dentist would still have to control the practice. But during that time, the spouse could transfer that practice, sell the practice to another individual. We also clarified some of the other mechanisms that have legitimate interest for owning a dental practice. They're nonprofits, corporations, et cetera, out there.
We have one fiscal note in your packet from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for $114,200 in receipt support services to pay for the one full-time investigator that is asked. Do we have initial questions from the committee members? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was curious, the first item in Section 1, the removal of the need for having a current certification of registration, is that simply because that's just redundant language and covered in Section 24? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. All right. And the other minor question was regarding the certification or inspection of equipment. I know it always concerns me when I go to the dentist and they do an x-ray and they put on the thing and step aside and I'm exposed, you know, and so I'm curious about who's actually overseeing the condition of the equipment. There's still safeguards within the bill that make sure that somebody that is certified to do this is taking care of the equipment or at least inspecting it?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, there still will be safeguards. Our expectation is most of what's in statute right now will be transferred into regulations with some minor modifications to bring it under the current federal statutes. There's overarching federal law in this case that you have to meet at least that minimum standard or you can go beyond there. But yes, there still will be requirements for qualifications of individuals inspecting, as well as a time allotment there that the equipment must be inspected on a periodic basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain to me why the Labor and Commerce Committee felt there was a need for the investigator?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, the chair, it was suggested to us by the committee who had worked on this that an investigator would be a more effective way of policing dental practices than it was currently. I can have Dr. Logan perhaps explain that in more detail.
And the committee is?
I'm sorry, sir?
The committee that worked on it is?
The committee that worked on the bill that brought it to us was composed of three dentists and three dental hygienists.
Okay, so you're not referring to the Labor and Commerce Committee?
No.
Can you help us with that question?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Yes, as was noted there, as we were working through and reviewing the Practice Act, there the board members expressed a concern about the length of time that it was taking cases to be adjudicated. It was just 4-5 years. At one point in time, there was a stop. The stopgap was at the Attorney General's office, and now it's getting investigator time. There's just a limited number of investigators, and the department has many investigations with many different boards that all have to be done there, and we felt that by having our own investigator, we could ensure that the investigations from the dental standpoint would be done in a timely manner, further protecting the public. We realize that that will result in additional license fees for the dentists and the hygienists there, but we're willing to accept that.
Okay. Any other preliminary questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a number of questions, if you'll bear with me, Mr. Chairman. I'm going back to page 18 that the co-chair went ahead and pointed out. As I read that section, it says only a person who holds a valid license issued under this may own, operate, and maintain a dental practice office or clinic. So you have to have, if you're going to own it, you have to have a valid dental license?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the next line is this restriction does not apply to, and then there's a laundry list of different ones that do not have to have a dental license.
Okay, as I read that, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue, so a community that's trying to attract a dentist to their small community especially, and they built themselves a dental clinic, they're exempted under this restriction?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that is correct. They could own the dental clinic. Mm-hmm. The day-to-day management of the clinic and the clinical decisions would still need to be done by a licensed dentist.
What does this bill have to do with prescriptive authority that's either given to or taken away from the mid-level practitioners or their equivalents out there besides dentists?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it has no effect.
Okay.
They're exempt from state licensure.
As I read this bill, the health corporations has a number of dental practitioners that have gone abroad to go ahead and get training and then have come back. Under Section 16, obviously it's a very sensitive issue because the Dental Society did sue for revoking these privileges. What effect does this bill have on those practitioners that are out there working for the Native corporations?
Let me take that. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson through the chair. We will be bringing language that clarifies that current practice in the rural areas of Alaska will not change. One of our attempts is to make sure that dentists practicing in the IHS dentists practicing in rural areas were able to continue to provide services to anybody in that area who comes in. And the original language that we had drafted didn't cover that specifically enough. And so we worked with attorneys from the South Central Foundation and our own drafter to incorporate into the language of the amendment, which you will see later, specific reference to federal law that authorizes that kind of practice.
I continue, Mr. Chairman.
Agreed.
As I looked through the bill and looked at the packet, I didn't see any letters of support from any of the health corporations. Do you have anything that would, since health corporations over landmass provides the majority of the dental care throughout the state of Alaska, except we have private practitioners mostly in South Central and some in South. Do you have any letters from these health corporations that are in support or opposing this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I believe I have some letters from the South Central Foundation, but I do not have letters from such as Senator Olson is requiring.
Okay, the question on Section 14 related to disciplinary action by the Dental Board, what's the latest on that status? And I guess I'd bring it up with Senator Hoffman in that having served on a medical board, they're always looking for more investigators. What makes this different than another board that's out there looking for another investigator so they can get a more timely disciplinary action underway?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I suspect you're going to see more boards making the same request and willing to pay the additional licensure fees necessary to have their own investigator.
Mm-hmm. Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Good.
Has to do with Section 23, the radiological procedures. How is that going to, I'm assuming that you're talking about, as was pointed out by Senator Thomas, that as you go in there, some of the people that are taking, some of the individuals or employees that are taking x-rays aren't necessarily the dentists, and you've got long, you know, somebody's been a dental assistant for a long period of time, she's been taking x-rays probably longer than the dentist has been alive. How does this restrict that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, those would be developed under regulation by the board. Any restrictions? I cannot speak for the board. We will have a board member online, or have a board member online, but I would be highly surprised if there would be any restrictions just because of the necessity for having individuals to perform those functions, especially in rural communities where the ability to be certified is somewhat limited.
One addendum, Mr. Chairman. As you looked at another investigator, and that's a big portion of the fiscal note that's there, how many disciplinary actions have you had within the last year, 2 years, or 5 years? And if you're not a member of the board, I can understand if you don't have that to justify this additional investigator.
Through the chair, I'm afraid I would be guessing on those numbers, but I believe the director is here in the room, so perhaps he'd be able to provide that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other preliminary questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, with that, we're going to go on to the public hearing portion. We're going to start with the off-net. What I'd like to do is to have you, of course, start by identifying yourself, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please. And we'll start with Deborah Stoffler.
This is Deborah Stoffler. I am a dental hygiene member of the Board of Dental Examiners and the secretary to the board as well. I also served on the ad hoc committee that started the revisions to the current legislation. The Board of Dental Examiners support unanimously the passage of Senate Bill 92. It really brings our statutes up to date, and so there's nothing else that we need to say about that. Are there any questions, though? I don't know what the person's name was who asked the question of how many complaints that we have. I have that activity as of February of this year, if you are interested in it.
Yeah, if you could give that to us, if you have it on hand.
I have it at hand. As of February 11th, there were 6 open complaints, and the status is that they're ready for review or in or preparing for review or awaiting records. There were 9 open investigations going, and some of those consent agreements were pending, others awaiting responses from respondents and that sort of thing. And then there are 9 other cases where there has been activity since the last meeting, which was December. And again, most of them are open cases awaiting records or waiting for release documents. So that's not very different from our November meeting, where we had 6 open complaints and 10 open investigations, and one case was closed in November. So there's pretty much activity, and I think the problem that we saw is recently, as of even just, I think it was May of last year, one case finally closed after more than 8 years under investigation. And during those 8 years, the dentist was allowed to practice. Since that May meeting, when we withdrew his license for 3 or 4 months, I can't recall. So we were pretty upset about that, since the first charge to the board is to protect the public from malpractice or other activities like that. And 8 years is too long to wait to get things taken care of, and having our own investigator, we think, will help protect the public and meet that charge, and we're willing to pay for it. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, what I'd like you to do is go ahead and put that data in a letter format and then respond back to the committee, and then we'll dispense it amongst the committee members in the packet.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for your we have a question from Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you go ahead and tell me how that compares to, say, the medical board, the number of open complaints that are there, the number of investigations?
I have absolutely no experience serving on the medical board, and so I wouldn't be able to respond to that question.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, there should be a comparison between how many cases are there and how many, if they do have, and I don't think they have a special investigator of their own.
We can get that data brought to the committee. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Next up, Gail Walden, please.
Thank you. Good morning, and my name is Gail Walden. I am a licensed dental hygienist from Wasilla, and I am a member and officer of the Alaska State Dental Hygienists Association. I am one of the three dental hygienists that was on the committee formed to review, update, and condense the Dental Practice Act. On that committee, I was representing the interests of the Alaska State Dental Hygiene Association and participated in all the discussions with other members from the Board of Dental Examiners and the Alaska Dental Society. A lot of time and effort was put into this by everyone that was involved, and today I am testifying on behalf of the Alaska State Dental Hygiene Association, and we currently support Senate Bill 92 for the following reasons. First, the Dental Practice Act has not been thoroughly reviewed and updated in a long time. I've heard approximately 20 years is an estimate. Secondly, Senate Bill 92 amends and repeals dental hygiene statute language where appropriate and makes the Practice Act more concise and a little bit more reader-friendly. And third, ultimately, one of the goals of our association is to maintain the highest standards of dental hygiene, licensure, and practice, and we feel that Senate Bill 92 maintains these high standards for dental hygienists so that we can continue to provide excellent care to Alaskans. And that's my testimony for today.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
That includes the LIOs and the off-nets. Let's come back into the room and ask Mr. Don Heberger to come forward. You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then help Senator Olson with his question, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Don Heberger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing for the State of Alaska Department of Commerce. To the Chair, Senator Olson, I understood your questions. Unfortunately, right today, I don't have those figures and those comparisons. I don't have it broken down like that, but I will get that to the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for the Division Director? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Any final comments, Senator Egan, before we set this bill aside?
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill, and we will provide additional information to you. And again, the committee will be supplied with an amendment at its next hearing.
Okay.
To clarify one section.
Okay, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, Senate Bill 66 by the Governor. Regarding the new market tax credit program. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is Mr. Mark Davis, Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, the Economic Development Officer. And if you could tell us what we have in front of us, please, after you introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Davis, and I'm with the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, which is better known by its acronym ADA. The bill before you is SB 66, a bill which lets ADA participate in and support a federal credit tax program known as New Markets Tax Credit. The bill is part of ADA's strategic plan to add new tools to its ability to further economic development in the state. The New Market Tax Credit Program is run by the Internal Revenue Service and was started in 2000. It is a unique equity leveraging program. The way it works is that people compete with IRS tax credits that are available through the U.S. Department of Treasury. They're awarded to what is known as Community Development Entities, or CDEs, and then those entities go out and look for investors. There's two sets of investors in this type of program. One are equity investors. Those are people that actually put cash into the particular project at issue, and then they're known as leveraged lenders, which is usually a bank. The equity investors in this program receive a 39% credit on their federal taxes over a seven-year period. So it's one of the largest tax credits available. The tax credits, however, are only available to low-income areas, certain rural areas, census tracts with less than 2,000 people, or to targeted populations such as Indian tribes. So this is a program that was developed by the Treasury Department to support development largely in low-poverty areas or in rural areas. And ADA was interested in this as part of its effort to provide economic development in more parts of the state. The program is also available to targeted populations which lack access to loans, which is a situation that we face in many rural areas of the state. The way it works is that once that a CDE has a tax credit, it goes out and finds investors that want to put money in and finds a bank that was willing to make the leveraged loan. And it has been used successfully in Alaska. The Platinum Fish Processing Plant was done with these credits, and also so is the elder care facility in Kotzebue, Alaska. Unfortunately, the program has not been robust lately because of the national credit crunch. The leveraged lenders under this program have to agree to two restrictions. First, to take interest only on the leveraged loan portion of the investment for 7 years, and they have to agree not to foreclose. The idea is that the project can use the equity capital put in by the qualified tax-driven investors and then pay interest only for 7 years. That patient capital lets a project get going. And then at the end of the 7 years, what usually happens is the equity investors forgive all their investment, and it's then refinanced. You can see what the program does, therefore, is give instant equity to that refinancing at the end of the seven-year period and lowers the cost of a project by approximately 20 to 25%.
If you could just help me with that forgiveness of the equity. I understand the forgiveness of debt, but
sure.
Forgiveness of equity.
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. The way in which this works is that the tax equity investors are driven by the 39% tax credit, and they usually actually exit the project immediately after the infusion of the equity. That is, they have no further contact with it. They take their 39%, and that's sufficient for their needs to have put that equity into the deal.
Well, I guess to put it another way, how many years do they have for the 39%?
They get it in a seven-year period. It adjusts over each year. There's different percentages for each year. It usually ranges in a range of 5 to 7% per year.
So they take that directly off their tax bill, and then what you're telling me that reduction in their tax bill, then they walk away from their initial equity position after so long?
That is usually what occurs, yes. There's a national report that came out in December of 2010, and it said that only 1% of these transactions resulted in some adjustment to the equity investors. So approximately 99% are in the format I have described.
Okay. And then the issue with the debt that is incurred, explain how that impacts it when the equity investor decides to forgive his equity.
The leveraged lenders on the other side of the equation, that's usually a bank, and it puts in approximately usually 70% of the funds in these type of projects, and at the end of 7 years, it's been collecting only interest. So obviously a bank cannot continue the loan at interest only. So at the end of 7 years, the residual amount of what's left on the loan is used for refinancing, and the equity that was put in originally can be used as a portion of your debt equity calculation to qualify for that refinancing.
Okay. Do you have any other initial questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still not quite clear on the forgiveness of the equity. Is the idea that the federal tax credits offset their equity in the seven-year period of time to a point that the person just says, that's fine, you know, I don't want my initial equity back, I'm satisfied with the tax credits that have gotten over that seven-year period of time or whatever it is?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, what these are investors who are looking, who have substantial tax liabilities, who are looking for tax credits, and there are actually consortiums of investors who hire people looking for new market tax credits opportunities, and actually ADA has been contacted by several, usually the 39% tax credit is what they are looking for in this kind of transaction. So it's a very leveraged transaction that's very good for the rural community, low-income community that gets this type of financing, because they get, at the end of the seven-year period, they have an equity position in the project, which is rare for 7 years only, and they're paying interest only for 7 years to the bank, and at the end of 7 years, they can refinance with conventional financing. The difficulty with this program has been after the credit crunch in 2008, banks have been unwilling to lend at interest only or without the ability to foreclose, which is another restriction on the program. Most states have operated as a community development entity. That is, they've actually taken over the task of putting these deals together. But we decided at ADA not to do that for two reasons. First, we already have a CDE in Alaska known as Alaska Growth Capital, which has already been active in the state and has done several projects. And so we looked at another approach, which has been used by New Jersey Economic Development Corporation, and that is where they have guaranteed the leveraged part of the loan. That is, they've guaranteed the bank loan portion of the project for the seven-year period. And we canvassed banks, and we talked to Alaska Growth Capital, and we also hired a consultant to help us with this. And the consensus was that an ADA guarantee would be sufficient to get this program going again in Alaska.
That was a thorough answer. Thank you.
Just elaborate a little bit more. So this kind of sounds like a no money down, 100% leverage, virtually a proposition in the end. So explain to me on the recourse or non-recourse that the lender has dealing with the capital or the project assets.
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. As I said at the beginning, there are severe restrictions on the bank. They have to agree to interest only, and they cannot foreclose during the seven-year period in which the credit exists. And so that means that their recourses are very limited. Additionally, the code provides that if the project fails, if payments are not made, then there's a recapture event to the equity investors. What that recapture means very simply that they have to pay back all of the credits they received with interest, which is at the interest repayment rate, which is not a favorable rate to the taxpayer. From the first date of the filing of the first return that claimed the credit, which means it goes all the way back to the first return, so that the penalties for failure are extreme from this Internal Revenue Service. Therefore, qualified equity investors go through these projects very carefully to make sure that they can perform for 7 years. That's one reason ADA believes that its offer of a guarantee does not incur much risk to the agency, because there's been a very low failure rate of these projects because the qualified equity investors make sure they work before they go in. Otherwise, they have substantial tax liabilities.
So the equity investor has to stand good for the debt if it implodes, or the project implodes within the first 7 years?
No, it doesn't have to go for the debt. It might be liable, but also has to pay back all the credits with interest. And if you've ever seen a tax bill, the interest can exceed the principal. So it can really be a large sum of money. So obviously no qualified equity investor wants these projects not to succeed.
All right. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that this program is targeting economically disadvantaged areas, that many of them are in rural areas of the state, and the program was reauthorized by Congress for an additional 2 years, I guess, beginning in January. What do you anticipate the success of the program might be in the 2 years? What type of an impact will it have in rural areas of the state?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I believe that ADEC could probably do 1 to 2 new market tax credits projects a year. That's because they're very complex. Unfortunately, they take a long time to put together, but they can be used, as you said, in areas that conventional lending is not reaching, and they can be used to leverage that lending so that you can have a project that wouldn't cash flow for 7 years. So it means that we could look at, like the Platinum Fish Plant or a processing plant in rural Alaska can be done in this fashion, which it would almost be it wouldn't be possible to do the project without it. Another advantage of this program is it has very few restrictions on the types of projects that can be funded. Most federal programs say that are restrictive of what you can do. Here, the list is very short. It's golf courses, massage parlors, and hot tubs.
Run that by me again.
It's also alcoholic beverage dispensaries. Essentially, except for golf courses, it's what the IRS considers to be non-savory businesses. I don't know how golf courses got included.
So, and I missed part of that earlier comment. You mentioned something about a fish plant, a catch can.
That was in Platinum, Alaska, yeah.
Pardon me?
Sorry. Mr. Chairman, it's in Platinum, Alaska.
So you're talking about a cold storage, or are you talking about a waste reduction plant? What?
Give me an example
of what.
This has been used for a fish processing plant, which actually processes fish. It's also been used for an elder care facility in Kotzebue that needed a patient financing to complete the project because it wouldn't cash flow for a while because it was just starting. It can be used for an industrial plant. It can be used to support office buildings. It's also been used to renovate buildings in low-income areas. It can be used for almost any type of project that legitimately furthers economic development.
And the population you mentioned earlier, is the population cap at 2,000?
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. Actually, three triggers. One is a census tract that has poverty, as Senator Hoffman noted. Another is a census tract which has a population of less than 2,000. Or a census tract which has a large targeted population. That is a population that has poverty, and by IRS regulation, Indian tribes are a targeted population, or a population that lacks access to loans.
Okay. Do you have any other initial questions for? We have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development. And maybe before we jump into the online, Mr. Davis, the cap at $40 million, why isn't it $10 million or $100 million? What's the magic number of 40?
Mr. Chairman, the original cap was $50 million, and the bill was originally introduced. And when we had a hearing before the Senate Community Economic Development Committee, Senator Menard suggested reducing the cap to $40 million, and ADA agreed to that reduction. We agreed on the $40 million because that would give us the ability to do probably 2 projects a year, given the typical size of these projects.
We have, we'll now go to the public hearing portion online. We have Mr. Ted Leonard. Do you have any comments after you introduce yourself?
Yes, to the chair and to the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Leonard with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. I'm the executive director. And I would say that Mark gave a very concise description of the project. And for ADA, what we are looking for through this statute is just another tool that we believe that we can use to promote economic development in rural areas and areas of the state that have poverty. And with that, to the chair, any questions that I could answer that Mark hasn't answered, I'm available to do.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Chris Kolarok?
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Chris Kolarok. I'm a consulting associate with Alaska Growth Capital. We are the only Alaskan entity with an allocation of new markets tax credits, and since it began, we've received $90 million in allocation. I'll offer some short testimony and be open to any questions you have. The New Markets Tax Credit Program is a powerful tool to bring Wall Street capital to Main Street, Alaska. There have been few deals done here, and these include the $40 million fish processing plant you've heard about in Platinum and the $18 million elder care facility in Kotzebue. My company, Alaska Growth Capital, is working to bring another elder care facility, a domestic violence shelter, and three village health clinics online or enhance their operations with NMTC financing. The impact for the community and Alaska as a whole is substantial for these buildings. And the reason is that NMTC's combined capital from investors with a loan, this combination creates first a federal tax break for the investing company, and that usually creates a return on investment for the investor of between 10 and 12%. Second, it creates an injection of capital to the qualifying project or business, and often this capital injection amounts to 20% or more of the total project cost. That provides the gap funding to allow completion and working capital until the business or nonprofit is stable in its operations. The loan can be difficult to secure because of the complexity with NMTCs. The lender would have the indirect security on a business or project and those seven-year restrictions you heard about earlier. That leaves lenders afraid to enter the NMTC business, and the Great Recession has exacerbated that problem, even though recovery is afoot. At a recent industry conference, lenders were coined unicorns of the NMTC world. Further, large banks that have experience with NMTCs are located far away from Alaska in places such as New York, San Francisco, and Charlotte, North Carolina. So when two projects must compete for unguaranteed loans, banks will often choose the project closer to them because they can be inspected, which provides security in the mind of the approving lender. We believe this bill will allow ADA to provide guarantees for NMTC transactions that would raise significant barriers for nonprofits and their capital fundraising, or for for-profit entities who must go through significant opportunity costs to save and secure their capital to engage in the program. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. That concludes everybody in the off-net. I have nobody signed up in the room here. Do we have any questions or anything? Okay, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, Senate Bill 90, Department of Labor and Commerce, regarding the Board of Public Accountancy. Secretary, we'll have a brief at ease. We'll come back on the record. We have modified the schedule a little bit today. 97 was moved down at the bottom of the calendar of the committee initially because we were waiting for a CS to come in, and that has arrived. So we moved that up for immediate review and potential action of the committee because there's an interest in getting it to the floor today. So with that, we're going to work on Senate Bill 97, and then we'll come back on to the regular schedule. We will run until 11 o'clock and stop, so we may not get all our other bill work done, depending on how things go. But with that, Senate Bill 97, Community Revenue Sharing and Education Funding. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time March 21st. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute and look to the committee for their will. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt CS for version E?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 97 Finance / E as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation, and we'll start with Mr. Tim Grusendorf. We also have Mr. David Teal with us today, and if you guys can introduce yourself for the record and then walk us through this, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. Before you have the CS for Senate Bill 97, and in this CS we addressed some of the items that we had mentioned that we were going to take another look at last meeting. The first adjustment that we were looking to make was we were looking to find the average price of oil and we were trying to look for a time frame in which that was going to be calculated. And it was, we had decided at this time to use the full year and for the average per barrel or price per barrel as our mark. We also added a few more, a safety cushion of $2 per barrel to make sure that the revenues are available and we don't end up overspending our surplus. So we still end up leaving us approximately $250 million as a cushion.
Mr. Grusendorf, we're going to stop there just for the people at home. Explain what the $2 over what is.
$2 over the average price per barrel. And
of the break-even rate of our operating and potential capital budget.
Correct. And David Teal will go over the details of this spreadsheet here and how we changed the calculation a little bit. I think the intent was the original bill was spinning out the percentage of the surplus around between 2 and 2.7% of the surplus for these programs, and we were looking to stay in that range. So the factors we chose here will produce the same type of number that we're looking at in the original bill. So some of these trigger points that you'll see accomplish that goal. And with that, I will turn it over to Ledge Finance Director David Teal.
For the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And as Mr. Grusendorf said, there are some major changes here. Primarily that it was the version D, the prior version of the bill was based strictly on price of oil, and that left you with the potential to share wealth that failed to materialize. So this version of the bill goes back and shares wealth only when there's a surplus. That delays it a year so that in fact what happens is you take the surplus for 1 year, FY12 for instance, which will determine the amount to be handed out in FY13. And should we just walk through the bill itself? Okay, in section one, it relates to supplemental funding for K-12 education. And A of that says that the amount to be handed out will be $5 million for each dollar difference between the actual price and the trigger price of oil. And Section B talks about the trigger price of oil, so we'll wait for that. It distributes that amount according to the K-12 Foundation formula. So it's equivalent to an increase in the base student allocation. It will be handed out in exactly the same way as money, as an increase in the base student allocation would be. And as I said, it's handed out the following year. So in B is where you compute the trigger price of oil. And in B1, it says we're going to take appropriations of unrestricted general funds, common language, that's just expenditures. And from that, we're excluding the community revenue sharing payments and the education payments made under this bill. Because if you tried to include them, you'd go into a loop trying to determine how much the surplus was. And you also exclude any deposits to the budget reserve fund because those are savings. We then take that level of appropriation and determine the break-even price of oil necessary to get there. And the committee has seen the break-even chart that Legislative Finance prepares that determines the price of oil needed to generate sufficient revenue to equal the expenditure level that we were just talking about. We take that break-even price of oil, round it to the nearest dollar and add $2. Mr. Chairman, as he said, that the $2 is simply a safety valve. That gives us sufficient money to make the appropriation to community revenue sharing and to K-12, and it also gives us something to to offset any errors that we make in revenue forecasts. As you know, $2 in the price makes a difference of approximately $200 to $250 million in revenue. So we just wanted to be sure we weren't sharing money that we didn't have. That wraps up the education portion of it. Section 2 turns to the revenue sharing portion. And Section 2B simply corrects an error that exists. It's unrelated to the supplemental community revenue sharing at all. It refers to the existing basic revenue sharing program. And it makes that fund recover more quickly if progressive taxation ever clicks off. In other words, if prices fall low and then recover to where we're at the stage of progressive taxation, basically above $60 per barrel, the fund recovers quickly instead of taking a couple years to do it. In Section 3, it changes the revenue sharing formula so that the amount distributed includes the basic revenue sharing portion, which is, I guess, in to put it briefly, is $60 million a year that's handed out now. It's really one third of the fund, but the fund is always $180 million because you hand out $60 million and recover $60 million in progressive taxation. And as long as we're at high prices, that cycle will continue and we'll just maintain a $60 million revenue sharing program. This says that in addition to the $60 million, you're handing out the amount calculated under D. Well, D is Section 4 of the bill. And that is mirrors the calculations that we just went through for the education portion, where you take the break-even price and add $2 and get a trigger price and figure out how much of a surplus you have and the amount that of revenue sharing is dependent upon that surplus. It's $5 for each dollar price that the actual price is above the trigger price.
Okay. Do you have any initial questions Mr. Teal?
Yeah.
Seeing none, Senator Hoffman, you have any comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that this is an excellent piece of legislation. It shares the wealth that we have at high prices with school districts and with the municipalities, and I know that they have additional costs as prices of oil increase, so I would strongly support the legislation, Mr. Chairman.
I'll go ahead and remove my objection for the adoption of Version E. Do we have any other objection to adoption of Version E? Seeing none, Version E is adopted. We have two fiscal notes in your packet from the Department of Education and Early Development and another from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And we're updating those fiscal notes. They are forthcoming. And again, the committee took public testimony at the last hearing. And do we have any final comments? We have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for Senate Bill 97 Finance /E with the forthcoming fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion to move Version E bill from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the forthcoming fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill to the next committee of referral. And again, this is targeted to be on the floor today. We're now going to get back on schedule. We have two pieces of legislation. There's a good opportunity here that we'll finish up our schedule today. We're going to get on track here with Senate Bill 90 by the the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee regarding the Board of Public Accountancy Secretary. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Egan is chair of the Labor and Commerce Committee. What say you on the bill?
Mr. Chair. The changes in the Board of Public Accountancy Secretary fixes an error that was created by passage of previous legislation. This corrects an error, and Dana Owen and my staff will present the bill.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and present the bill, which is one paragraph and one sentence, and tell us what the error is that we're correcting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm a staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Last year, this position was established in law, and the money to pay for the position at a range 23 was incorporated into the budget. However, because the range was not established in statute, the Department of Administration felt that it was necessary to do a classification study for this position, and they determined that it should be a range 19. The certified public accountants of the state decided or felt that that was insufficient to hire the kind of person that they wanted in the position, and they asked that we establish in statute this position at a range 23. That's the sole purpose behind the bill.
Okay. Do we have any initial questions? And there's one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. It's a zero fiscal note, by the way. We have one person signed up online. We'll go to the public hearing portion. Again, if you could please state your name and who you represent and speak to the bill. Lisa Rogers, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Lisa Rogers. I'm a CPA in Anchorage. I represent the Alaska Society of CPAs as the Legislative Committee Chairman. The Alaska Society of CPAs and the Board of Public Accountancy supports Senate Bill 90. I am aware of no opposition to this bill. Our profession needs a competent executive secretary, and we don't mind paying one for one through our licensing fees, which is how this position will be funded. Our profession is regulated by statutes and regulations of various jurisdictions, such as federal law, state law, territories, possessions, and localities all have laws, in addition to various standard-setting bodies, including the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, the International Association of Accounting Standards Board, the PCAOB, OMB, SEC. I mean, I could just go on, and I just can't emphasize how much we need a very competent person in that position, because that person will be helping to facilitate investigations, and if they don't understand just how complex our profession is, they're not going to be able to do it, and we don't believe that a person paid at a range 19 is going to have the qualifications.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
If anyone has any questions, I answer them the best that I can. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony this morning. That we have nobody signed up at the LIOs, and nobody in the room signed up. So we have any questions for the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, our final piece of labor today, Senate Bill 94 by Senator Davis regarding the second verse of the Alaska flag song. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. We have Senator Davis coming forward. If she could introduce herself when she's ready and tell us what this bill does.
Good morning to the co-chairs and the members of the Finance Committee, and thank you very much. I'm Senator Betty Davis. I represent District K, Anchorage, east side of Anchorage. We have before you today the second verse of the Alaska State Flag Song. This bill has been heard in two other committees, Community and Regional Affairs, State Affairs, and you have it now before you. It's a very simple bill. It's to add the second stanza to the Alaska Flag Song, State Song, rather. I also would like to say I appreciate the fact that you're taking this in a timely manner, and I would like for my aide to just run you through. I know there are some people that want to testify. Just run through the bill. It's quite simple, but I'd like to give her that opportunity for the experience, if you don't mind.
We can do that, Senator Davis.
Yes. Pamela Marsh.
Okay, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you very much, Chairman and members of the committee. I want to speak to the bill. My name is Pamela Marsh, P-A-M-E-L-A, Marsh, M-A-R-S-C-H. Senate Bill 94 would add a second verse to the Alaska flag song. The late Carol Beverly Davis was a beautiful second verse which gave recognition to the Alaska Natives and to Benny Benson, who designed the Alaska flag. Similar bills have been introduced in the past. Last year, the Alaska flag song was performed with both verses as the Senate gaveled in on the first day of session. Also last year, the senator from District G introduced SB 43. It passed the Senate, but it stalled in the House. This year is the year to join me in supporting a long overdue addition to the second verse to the Alaska flag song. By passing this bill, you will be recognizing history, our progress as a state, and our first people. Thank you.
We have any initial questions from the committee members? There is one indeterminate fiscal note from the Office of the Governor. We have one person signed up.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
you
Davis.
Spoke to the indeterminate fiscal note, and would I get a chance to speak to that after you take the public testimony?
If you wish to speak to the indeterminate fiscal note, you can do it right now, Senator.
All right, I would like to do that. In the last committee of referrals, which was State Affairs, they had negotiated with the people that wrote the note and had agreed that it's possible that there would not be a note based upon the letter of intent that was submitted by State Affairs, which is in your package. I would hope when you review this that your committee would also agree and that this bill would go forward without an indeterminate note, but also a zero note. And that's just my comments on that.
Okay.
And it is in the package.
All right. Okay, thank you. That, if Ronnie Davis, if you can come forward. Introduce yourself for the record, Lonnie, and who you represent, and tell us what you think of the bill.
I am Connie Davis, and I represent myself in regard to the second verse of the state song, which was written by my mother. And I would want to give a little summary of what I know of the University of Alaska Foundation. This organization is legally separate from the university itself. It manages gifts and donations for the benefit of the university. The copyrights of the Alaska State Song and verses are held in trust by the University Foundation. Therefore, the state is not responsible for any problem that might arise, legally or financially, in regard to the second verse. And I have a copy of a blank second note, if you'd like to see it, from the year 2002, fiscal note with 0000. Thank you.
Good, thank you for your testimony.
Oh, any questions?
No questions. But thank you for coming in today. That concludes everybody on the sign-up. That will conclude our public hearing portion. Do we have any final questions for Senator Davis on the bill? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next meeting will be tomorrow, 9 a.m., to hear an overview of roads to resources from the Department of Transportation. Unless members have any comments or concerns, which I don't see, we are adjourned.